Welcome back, members. Committee Secretary has the South African Catholic Bishops joined?
Yeah, I believe they are with us. I called them and they were getting ready. Yeah, he is here.
I'm here, Mr. Chairperson. I'm here.
Thank you very much. Can we start? You have 20 minutes to present.
Thank you, Chairperson, and members of the committee. Thanks for the opportunity to speak to you about this. Unfortunately, I was not able this morning to listen to all the other presentations. So if I do repeat anything that has already been said, I apologize for that. In any event, I don't think I'll be taking up the full 20 minutes. We don't have that much to say. I don't have a presentation as such. I believe that all members of the committee will have our written submission, which we sent in last year. Let me begin by just talking briefly about the hate crimes side of the bill. We all know that we have so many crimes that are motivated or exacerbated by hatred in this country. You can think of xenophobic attacks and corrective rape and all sorts of other horrible things which are happening. And it's correct that the criminal justice system obviously should take note of this and act against it. But our question is whether, in fact, it is necessary to create a special class of crimes called hate crimes, when really the only difference between them and any other crime is the matter of motive. If we look at Clause 3.1, we see that a hate crime is an offence recognised under any law. So they're pre-existing offences. And then it simply goes on to say which is motivated by prejudice or intolerance. So it's not really a new class of crime, although it sounds that way when people talk about hate crimes, that it is something new. So if really what we are wanting to deal with here is the question of motive, then we question whether we need to go to this extent of, as I say, seeming to create a new class of crime, giving the impression that there is a whole set of new crimes out there that have been somehow discovered, like things like we have with cybercrime and so on, which are indeed new and didn't exist before. This is not the same thing. And that could cause a degree of confusion. It would also be a relatively easy thing simply to amend the Criminal Procedure Act and the Criminal Law Amendment Act, the so-called Minimum Sentences Act, simply to indicate to presiding officers that if they find that a particular murder or rape or assault or whatever else has been motivated by hatred, that they are to take that into account specially when it comes to sentencing. So that's really our question. Do we need to, as it were, pretend that we have discovered a new set of crimes that need a new law to deal with them? Can we not rather simply use the existing criminal statutes to accommodate this particular kind of a motive? If, however, it is decided that it is necessary to proceed with this creation of this new set of crimes, hate crimes, then we would like to draw some attention to particular points in Clause 3.1 of the bill, which seem to be perhaps a little bit unclear or don't immediately make a lot of sense. Clause 3.1, for example, refers to the characteristics or perceived characteristics of the victim of the crime or his or her family member. Family member is not defined anywhere. So the question is, what constitutes a family member? And how far do we go? That's the sort of thing where one can quite imagine a court might have some difficulty applying the law. And indeed, just, you know, for legal clarity, anyone who falls foul of this law needs to know what it actually covers. So at the very least, I would suggest that the idea of a family member needs to be somehow narrowed down or defined. And why is it only family members? to which this extends, and not just, for example, friends or associates or romantic partners and so on of the victim. You know, it seems to be, in that sense, quite arbitrary and perhaps hasn't been fully thought through. Then still with 3.1, what is meant by association and support in the phrase, the victim's association with or support for a group of persons? Once again, it's vague. Terms like association and support are extremely vague, very difficult to define, and therefore are they going to be very difficult to apply when this sort of thing comes before a court. Then when we look at further at association with or support for, why should it apply only to a group of persons who share certain characteristics and not to an individual person who happens to have such characteristics? That, again, that doesn't seem to make any sense. I will fall foul of this law if I commit a hate crime because of the victim's association with a group of people, but not if the victim is associated only with a single individual who bears those characteristics. So once again, that doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. And then in the list of characteristics A to P under section 3.1, we find that marital status, conscience, and pregnancy, which are all listed in the Constitution as grounds for unfair discrimination, have been left out of this list of characteristics. And again, it's not clear why, when all of the others have been included, those three should be left out. It is surely possible. It might be unusual, it might be strange, but it is possible that someone could have a hatred of somebody else on a matter of conscience, for example, and commit a crime against that person because of something that is motivated by that person's conscience or even by their marital status. As I say, it might be very unlikely, but it certainly is possible. And things like political affiliation and occupation and trade are included on this list when they are not immutable characteristics of a person, such as their race and their age and their sex and so on. So again, we suggest that all of those points under 3.1 contribute to vagueness and uncertainty, and perhaps they need some further definition or tightening up. Otherwise, one can envisage that when these matters eventually come before court, there's going to be room for a lot of confusion there. So much for, the other point about hate crimes is we support the provision in clause 3.3 that prosecutions for such crimes should be authorized by the relevant DPP. We think that such prosecutions should be used sparingly and only when absolutely necessary, and it's correct that therefore a particular decision should be taken by the director of public prosecutions. That echoes also the similar provisions in the Prevention of Organized Crime Act when it comes to furthering the racketeering and activities of a gang and things like that. That also has to be specifically authorized by the DPP. So that it seems to be consistent with that approach. Moving into hate speech. Again, we can't deny the prevalence of hurtful and insulting outbursts. This really does violate people's dignity, damages the social fabric, and of course also demeans the person who utters hate speech. But we question whether criminal legislation is the appropriate or the most effective way of combating what is essentially an attitudinal problem and a social problem. And the more that we do try to, as it were, rein in or circumscribe what people can say, the more we risk violating other fundamental freedoms, such as freedom of belief and opinion, and of course, freedom of expression, freedom of speech. And I'm sure that many other presenters have gone into much detail about this. We already have in the Promotion of Equality and Prevention of Unfair Discrimination Act provisions that outlaw speech that advocates hatred or which is intended to be harmful or to incite violence. Limited grounds, yes, in that act in PAPUDA, but that could easily be remedied by an amendment if it's felt necessary. And of course, we also have the Constitution itself, which circumscribes or limits free speech as not including speech which is intended to be hatred, to incite violence, and so on. So once again, the question is, do we really need this? If we didn't have these hate speech provisions, would we be able to use existing statutes to achieve the same end? And it seems to us that the answer is yes, we could. We've mentioned in our written submissions the question of the chilling effect. And again, I'm sure this has been brought up to you already this morning. We don't want a society where people become scared to open their mouths and to express opinions and to engage in debates because they have become oversensitive to the possibility that what they say, even if it is very sincerely and genuinely meant, that it will be taken as advocacy of hatred, or that it will be seen as something which causes harm to other people. We need to have room for robust exchange of opinions and a robust approach to free speech. Are we balancing? Are we going to find the correct balance between the free speech and freedom of information rights and what is ultimately the need to protect people's dignity by preventing hate speech? Are we going to find the correct balance if this bill is passed? And I think it's questionable. Much will depend, obviously, on how courts ultimately interpret this statute. They may find certain aspects of it unconstitutional. They may read in certain definitions which are not there. But the risk is there that this is going to go too far in the direction of curtailing free speech, freedom of information, freedom of expression in various ways. Clause 4 of the bill, which deals with the offence of hate speech, it may in itself be directly unconstitutional, since it very clearly limits the right to freedom of expression, without at the same time satisfying the conditions for limitation as set out in Section 36 of the Constitution. One reason is that it uses the concept of harm as one of the two criteria for judging whether speech qualifies as hate speech. Clause 4.1a small I refers to the communications that have a clear intention to be harmful or to incite harm. And harm is in turn defined very, very widely as any emotional, psychological, physical, social, or economic harm. So even very trivial degrees, very minor kinds of harm, which, you know, most people might be inclined just to ignore or to brush off, could qualify as hate speech. Is that where we want to go? Is that constitutionally justified? I suspect it's not constitutionally justified. In effect, what's happening is that the prohibition of hate speech is being turned into a positive right that people have not to be offended or upset. And clearly this is a very subjective question. I may feel upset or offended in my interiorly because somebody has said something to me, where again, most other people would not feel at all upset by it. But if I do, then I have suffered harm. And then theoretically, the person who said whatever they said to me falls foul of this law. It seems to go much too far. There is certainly no right in our Constitution not to be offended or not to be upset. you could argue that the right to dignity can be extended into that area to, you know, to some degree, but it certainly can't be extended to the point that every single piece of subjective feeling of upset or offense can be covered. And yet that appears on one reading, the obvious reading of section 4.1, to be where this will take us. I've already mentioned that this places a major restriction or limitation on the right to freedom of expression. The greater the extent of the limitation, the limitations clause of the Constitution tells us this, that the greater the extent of the limitation, the less likely it is to be justifiable in an open and democratic society. And Section 36 also tells us that the limitation of a right is only justifiable if there are no other less restrictive means to achieve the purpose. And we suggest that this requirement could be satisfied by qualifying the word harm in such a way that it excludes minor or very trivial utterances and makes clear that the fact that someone who takes offense, that the mere fact that someone takes offense at the words of another is not in itself sufficient to establish harm or harmfulness. In other words, there needs to be some sort of objective set of criteria here where both people who are in the business of promoting free speech, you know, commentators.
You're left with 5 minutes.
Yeah, thanks. People in the media in particular, where they know exactly where the line is, where the line is that they may not cross. And also, such a definition of harm would assist courts when they have to obviously then apply the definition and find out whether someone crossed the line or not. At the moment, it is just way too vague to be really at all useful. Specific concerns around the hate speech provisions, clause 4.2, and I know that this was something which was to a large extent negotiated after earlier versions of this bill with certain interest groups or social sectors, creates a certain number of exclusions. So artistic creativity, academic inquiry, reporting and commentary, and religious interpretation and proselytizing are excluded from the strict prohibitions. It's good in a way that this happens because it does help us to sort of rescue free speech and the sharing of information. But again, we question in paragraphs 25 onwards of our submission whether this is being done in a consistent way. And to put it as plainly as we can, why is it that a priest might be allowed by this law to express a view on something like same-sex marriage, which, if that view was expressed by someone who was not a priest, would constitute hate speech? It seems a very risky undertaking to start making exceptions to things. And more than that, it probably violates the equality sections of the Constitution because it's making people unequal before the law. If I stand up in church and I say something about same-sex marriage, this law says, okay, you're allowed to because you're a priest, or because you're an artist, or because you're an academic. But if someone who doesn't happen to be in one of those professions says exactly the same thing, they're going to be guilty of a crime. We don't think that that is workable. And I'm very much aware when I say that some of my colleagues in the religious sector have been pushing very hard for this exception, to put it as bluntly as I agree with them. In paragraph 27, we also point out that when you start to make these exceptions, you're also then illustrating the untenability of trying to restrict free speech in the way that this bill is trying to do it. You're bringing in a certain amount of arbitrariness, which is never acceptable when we want to have the rule of law and when we want everyone to be equal before the law. We've suggested that clause 4.1a could be rewritten to take account of most of these problems. so that it would read, any person who intentionally publishes or propagates anything or communicates anything to one or more persons in a manner that could be reasonably construed to demonstrate a clear intention to advocate hatred, that constitutes incitement to cause harm based on one of the grounds, etc. So it's going back to the constitutional linkage between speech that advocates hatred and the incitement to cause harm. That takes away the elements of triviality, and it takes away also the defenses of, you know, you're saying this because you're a priest, or you're saying this because you're a journalist or an academic, whatever. No one should be able to put out speech that incites harm to other people. Of course, we're not talking about trivial harm, serious harm. I think, Chairperson, that really is the essence of what we want to say. I'm not going to repeat some of the things that I've already said, paragraphs 29 and 30. Once again, we do support the idea that hate speech prosecutions would have to be authorized by the DPP for the same reasons as hate crime prosecutions. And lastly, we strongly support Clause 9 of the bill. We do agree that the state has a duty to prevent and combat acts and behavior, including speech, that involves or really promotes hate. Because we're talking about an educational campaign here, really, an awareness-raising and educational campaign that needs to happen in our country. Definitely a responsibility of the state. It's definitely a responsibility of civil society, and I would say in certain areas, particularly of the faith community, to have a hand in this, to bring about a situation of greater respect and tolerance for other people and their many different characteristics, and to move away from this feeling that some of us seem to have in our country, that we continually need to be telling other people that they are wrong, or that certain characteristics that they have are unacceptable. So, to conclude, Chairperson, we question very much whether there is a need for this category of hate crimes, and we submit that the bill goes too far when it speaks about hate speech towards limitation of freedom of speech, and it needs to be quite severely tightened up. In brief, that's what our
suggestion is. Thank you very much. Members, are there any questions? Honorable Kubutile Janji, followed by Honorable Glenis Breitenbach, in that order.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much, Chair. Let me thank the Catholic Bishops Conference. It's more of a commentary, Chair, and perhaps I'll ask him as a brief question at the end. To say that I think, certainly for me, he has really put forward very probing questions and probing issues. Has made me to think much, much deeper. And I when he stopped talking, I had a sense of a homework that needs to be done to verify a lot of these issues. So I want to appreciate that presentation, which goes, which is so comprehensive and touches the important issues. Perhaps, Chair, as I mull over all of these probing questions he has put, to just ask him, of all the issues that he has put on the table, what is this one or two things that he feels strong about, that as Catholic Bishops Conference, that at least if this could not be factored in, this bill will be poorer in terms of its content and so that I don't, he's raised so many issues. But I'm interested in that one or two issues that would really be a defining feature, either as a lack of or what we need to have. I hope he understands my question. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Janji. Honorable Glenis Breitenbach.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning to everybody. Chair, yes, I largely agree with this presentation, and I've been covered in questions by the question of the Honourable Junkie. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Rutenbach. Over to you, Mr. Pothier.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you.
Sorry, before you proceed, there's also another hand of Honourable Masekwa Chaele.
Thank you very much, Chair. My apologies for my video. Serious, I mean, acacia. So there's a serious problem with this the issue of network. Thank you, Chairperson, and also good morning, colleagues, and also our presenters. And also, Chair, let me just ask, it's one or two questions. Two questions from Mr. Mike. I didn't get that. Okay, sorry for that. Chair, my question would be, it seems as if there is a growing, listening to the presentation, concern that it's not a concern per se, but they are just highlighting the issue that it might be not necessary for us to have this bill, though one way or the other also they support the progress and then and the process, and then also give us some indication in terms of if this happens to be like the way we are having it now. He did indicate earlier that in the presentation that there are some legislations that covers most of the issues that are being presented by this bill. Maybe like the other presenters, when they are saying it might not, it was not going to be, maybe if we don't need this, let me just put it like that in a simple terms from my understanding. So my question is that what could maybe be the problem that might have brought us here that the courts and could not identify from those acts or the legislation that we have already that might maybe make us, that made us to be where we are today? I'm not sure if maybe my question is clear, but I'm trying to go somewhere in terms of saying maybe it might not be necessary for us to have this bill, but we might strengthen whatever that we have now currently. And then the other one, clarity question is that maybe he did mention something in the presentation also that the when we talk about the hate crime or hate speech, there are those that are serious and there are those that are trivial. Maybe to him, I just want to find out maybe an example as to which one that might not be that serious. Because to me, I thought that maybe anything that is hateful, it is serious to the person that it is directed to. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Pothier.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you in particular to Mr. Gianti for his comments. The question about what do we feel strongest about here? I think in a general sense, our strongest concern is about the as I said, the effect that the bill will have in limiting or circumscribing our freedom of speech. But it's not just freedom of speech, because freedom of speech is so intimately linked to other freedoms, freedom of information, obviously, the whole freedom of the media in various ways. It's intimately linked to social debate and even political debate, the exchange of ideas, our right to criticize in good faith the ideas and standpoints of other people, and so on. So freedom of speech is a very, very wide-ranging and, in a democracy, an absolutely essential right. So I would say that probably our central concern is that this bill directly threatens to limit that that right, and in an indirect sense through this phenomenon of the chilling effect, that people may become nervous about expressing their views, even asking questions, joining in debates, for fear that what they are saying sincerely may be interpreted as constituting hate speech. So that would be our general strongest concern. And in a very specific sense, I think that this word harm has to be somehow, if not defined, and I'm not sure if it can be defined absolutely, it needs to be qualified. And I think there I link up with Ms. Maseko's question as well, the difference between serious and trivial hate speech. It's a little bit like the difference between serious and trivial harm. In the law, there is the concept that the courts have used for many, many centuries, I think, which is called the de minimis rule, the Latin phrase de minimis non curat lex. The law does not concern itself with trifles. We have a jurisprudence that we can go to find out what are those things that are so unimportant, so trivial, that even though, for example, it may constitute theft. If I pull a leaf off a tree in your garden and I take that leaf away, I have stolen a leaf from your tree. It is, strictly speaking, theft. I didn't have a right to do that. But if you try to take me to court, the court is going to throw it out and say, this is so trivial, don't waste our time about this. We need to try to understand how this applies in the area of hate speech as well. And I can't sit here and give you a perfect example. But I think we all perhaps know that some people are far more sensitive to criticism or to being called names or to having accusations made against them than other people are. Each of us in our own hearts, I think, can understand that a certain thing said to us, yes, it might be a little bit upsetting. Yeah, we would prefer that you didn't say that, but it's not a big deal. It's not going to really harm me. It's not going to, you know, set me back and cause real hurt. But the same thing said to somebody else, well, it might do so. Now, how is a court supposed to deal with that? Because the court cannot proceed simply on the subjective feelings of the person who has heard these words. So there must be a difference between serious and trivial hate speech. I don't know exactly where that difference is, but we can again go back to our constitution. Constitution, I think, for the primary guidance there. And the Constitution in Section 16 talks about speech that is either propaganda for war or incitement of imminent violence or advocate of hatred that constitutes an incitement to cause harm. And again, I know that the word harm is once again not defined in the Constitution, but it sounds to be very much like what is being considered there is some sort of physical material harm to somebody rather than just perhaps an injury to feelings. It's as Mr. Gianti said, perhaps there's some homework that needs to be done to come up with useful definitions and qualifications of some of these phrases. There was another question of what has brought us to where we are with this. And as I said at the beginning of our presentation, no one can deny that we have a problem in this country of that we do violate each other's dignity in the way that we speak about each other. Much of this comes from our history, not all of it. Other things have to do with things like patriarchy, gender relationships, and so on. We need to address that. The question for your committee is whether legislation and, if you like, sort of sledgehammer approach of the law, and in particular the criminal law, is the correct way of addressing this. And we have our doubts whether it can be successfully addressed through the criminal law. This is much more of a kind of social problem that needs to be addressed with proper formation of people, proper educational campaigns, proper work in our schools, and so on. We do have laws in place. There's the common law, the crimen injuria crime, where you can be fined, sent to jail for uttering horrible speech, insulting speech to another person. And we've seen, for example, under our Equality Act, we've seen people being taken to court under the Equality Act, made to pay fines, made to apologize for using racially offensive language and things like that. It's not that we don't have any legal redress for speech that constitutes hate and speech that is really trying to harm someone's dignity. We do have them. And maybe we should make more use of those rather than simply throwing a new law into the pot as well.
Thank you very much, Advocate Pothia. Members, I have been advised that the other organizations like the Institute of Race Relations, Accountability Lab South Africa, are not ready now because I think we have been very efficient with time. We are too ahead of the time we had set for ourselves. So the Institute of Race Relations will be ready at 1:30. That will be followed by Accountability Lab South Africa, Access Chapter 2, and Southern Africa Liaison Office. Those are the organizations that we will have after lunch at 1:30. So my suggestion is that because there's nothing we can do, they're not ready, that we take a long lunch, and then we come back at 1:30 to start with the Institute for Race Relations. Then the other suggestion, members, I tried to get hold of Advocate Breitenbach and Honorable Horn yesterday and Honorable Ntlozi. The suggestion that we have is that we will be left with 7 organizations for the public hearings after today, that we proceed with the public hearings when we come back from recess. I know that quite a number of ANC members, it will be a difficult day tomorrow to be, in fact, some of them will be arriving. And then also we have to prepare for the debate at 2:30. Because, for instance, in terms of our planning, even if we had proceeded tomorrow with 7 organizations, there was always a possibility that we might, between 9 and 2 and 1, we might not be able to finish all of them. So there was always going to be a spillover effect to the other day. So my suggestion is that we proceed with the public hearings after today. When we come back, we have 1 or 2 days to finish the public hearings, and then we proceed with other issues. Will that be in order, members?
That's fine, Mr. Chair. I apologize. Yesterday when you called me, I was on a flight. I did call you, but then I assume you were on a flight. So, but that's absolutely fine.
Okay, thank you very much, Honorable Breitenbach. Honorable Janji?
No, it's an order, Chair. It's just for today that from 1:30, Honorable Ngola and myself will be in the Section 194 committee. It's a very important meeting to talk about our roadmap and so on.
Okay. No. Thank you very much, members, for your understanding. Then the Friday meeting. Honorable Janji, you have a subcommittee in the morning. Is that correct?
Quickly check that with CIA Chair, and then I'll give you.
Okay. Because you remember members were agreed on that meeting where we will just be reflecting on the term under review and planning for the next term with the decisions of the meetings we have taken since our last strat plan. So one of the reasons also that we felt that it would be important to allow administration to ensure that they use tomorrow fruitfully, so that on Friday they are ready to make that presentation and we can do sort of a review of our term and the proper planning for the next term.
Just on our side, we don't have a subcommittee this Friday, so that you are able to
start in the morning.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much. So, members, that day will be reserved for our internal discussions. As a committee, it will be an internal committee meeting to deal with our own internal issues. Thank you very much, members. Can we adjourn for lunch, for a long lunch? As a reward for us being efficient, we are rewarding ourselves, so we'll come back at 1:30.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Chair, are we locking off or using the same number when we come back?